We don't have a quorum yet, but we're going to start the meeting, and this is an overview of the what the state gets out of the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, and our House research people and some folks from Department of Health and the Department of Commerce will be talking about the bill. So, Randy, I think you're up first. And we're looking forward to a very stimulating discussion.
You've been waiting all day for that,
haven't
you? Welcome back, by the way.
Mr. Chair and members, Randy Chen with House Research. I'll start off going over the Medicaid provisions, and then Ms. Lanier will follow me with more with the TANF and social service provisions. I'm operating a document called Federal Stimulus Act Medicaid Provisions, and I won't go over this entire document in detail. I'll focus more on the federal medical assistance percentage changes and then give this brief overview of some of the other provisions. First of all, FMAP stands for Federal Medical Assistance Percentage. This is the percentage of state Medicaid spending that the federal government pays for. And each state has a different FMAP. It's calculated using a formula that compares state per capita income with national per capita income. Minnesota's current FMAP is 50%. Absent a similar bill, it would have remained at 50%, which is the lowest rate. The bill provides various adjustments to FMAP, and let me maybe just start out by saying that the way to access these adjustments is that the state needs to basically spend money on a Medicaid service. So in other words, when the state spends money on something, it'll get the higher FMAP. If the state were to, reduce spending on something, obviously you wouldn't then get the higher FMAP for those reductions. The bill for the act provides three types of adjustments. The first is a hold harmless provision, and this basically states that under the regular standard FMAP formula, if a state were to have its FMAP percentage reduced for purposes of this of the period covered by the bill, which is October 1st, 2008 through December 31st, 2010. It would retain the higher FMAP. Your standard FMAP could not go down. This provision does not help Minnesota because we're already at the lowest 50% FMAP. The second increase is an increase of 6.2 percentage points in FMAP. All states receive this, and there's a table which incorporates data from DHS that lists the amounts of additional federal funding we'd receive through the 6.2% percentage point increase. The third increase is called an unemployment-related FMAP increase. This increase basically gives states that experience large increases in unemployment an additional bump to their FMAP percentage. And the Act defines high unemployment state as one that experiences an increase in its unemployment rate for a three-month period equal to more than 1.5 percentage points. And what you're doing is you're comparing the state's unemployment rate for the period October 1st, 2008 to December 31st, 2010. You're taking the average unemployment rate for a quarter, and you're comparing it to the lowest unemployment rate in any quarter from the period beginning January 1 of 2006. And what the federal act does is it groups unemployment rates into three tiers. And the higher the tier, the greater the bump to your FMAP. If a state qualifies for this unemployment-related adjustment, it can retain it for the duration of this recession period. So your FMAP then can't go down. However, the FMAP that's tied to the unemployment rate can go up if your unemployment rate, gets worse during the period covered by the bill. So the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services has told DHS that the additional FMAP increase for Minnesota based on this unemployment factor will be 3.99 percentage points and this will be for the first three quarters of federal fiscal year 2009. This is based on Minnesota being in that middle tier of states. It's projected that Minnesota, beginning with the quarter beginning July 1st of 2009, will move up to the third tier, and the FMAP percentage increase will be 5.39 percentage points. And again, there's a table listing the expected additional federal funding that we receive through this adjustment. So overall, Minnesota's FMAP, when you combine both the 6.2% and this additional unemployment-related increase, is expected to be 60.19% for the first two quarters of federal fiscal year 2009. And again, this is compared to our regular FMAP of what would have been 50%. This increase in FMAP applies to services provided under the Medicaid program. It also increases by 6.2% foster care and adoption assistance grants. The increase in FMAP does not apply to TANF grants. It doesn't apply to the state chosen health insurance program, which already gets an enhanced match. It doesn't apply to disproportionate share hospital payments. It doesn't apply to services that already get an enhanced federal match. It doesn't apply to persons who would become eligible for medical assistance due to higher income standards that would take effect after July 1st of 2008. And again, it doesn't apply to services provided after December 31st of 2010, which is the end of this recession adjustment period. In order to qualify for the higher FMAP, states need to meet a maintenance of effort requirement.
Mr. Stone, can you give us a list of services that are already receiving an enhanced federal match?
Let me start.
I know one is family planning. We get
right, and there are some higher matches for I think fraud assistance initiatives and so on. But I'll get a list for you at the committee. The maintenance of effort language reads that a state is not eligible for an increase in its FMAP if eligibility standards, methodologies, or procedures under its Medicaid plan, including a Medicaid waiver or an 1115 demonstration waiver, are more restrictive than the standards, methodologies, and procedures in effect on July 1st of 2008. And the general rule is if a state has passed more restrictive procedures and methodologies, it doesn't get a federal match until the first calendar quarter for which the state has reinstated eligibility at the former level. There's also sort of a grace period where if a restriction was applied after July 1st of 2008, but before the February 17th enactment date, and if the state before July 1, 2009 sort of reinstates the higher levels, then it doesn't lose the federal match. And there's also provision that the state will not be in violation of this maintenance of effort requirement if a restriction would have been effective as of July 1st of 2008, except for the fact that there was a need for federal approval under a demonstration waiver.
Mr. Chen, but we can change benefit packages, is my understanding.
Mr. Chair, yes, that's correct. The maintenance of effort applies just to, again, these standards, methodologies, and procedures. And I should mention that there are obviously a lot of questions about what, you know, these terms mean, and my understanding is that CMS is going to be issuing some sort of written clarification to the departments.
Representative Abrams.
I'll be brief. I was doing well when you said July 108, and then you have all this other clarifying language. And I know that most of our new eligibilities take place July 1 compared to August 1. Is that
mm-hmm.
Yeah. So when we do a new thing. So June 30th would be a different whole set of standards than July 1st. I was understanding that. So is that the real date we need to look at, or is there some other eligibilities, like there's some programs didn't go into effect for reasons they were delayed? Do those count? Is July 1 the date? Does that make sense? Is that the real date?
July 1 date, you know, it's the date specified in the Act, but as I mentioned, there, I think a lot of these questions, such as the one you're asking that I think still need to be clarified by the federal government. You know, for example, there's another question about whether or not provisions that we may have passed that would be extensions that are not yet approved, you know, are those sort of protected by the maintenance of effort requirement? I think at this point we don't know that.
Thanks. I'll stop there.
To Chair and members, the Act also has a prompt pay requirement. Provides that a state is not eligible for the FMAP increase for days during any period in which the state is not in compliance with Medicaid prompt pay requirements. And the Medicaid requirement would require 90% of clean claims to be paid within 30 days of receipt and 99% of all claims to be paid within 90 days of receipt. The Secretary of Health and Human Services has the authority to waive the prompt pay provision and can waive some related reporting requirements when there are exigent circumstances, including natural disasters that prevent the timely processing of claims, submissions, and reports. Again, that is basically the language from the Act, and the Act doesn't further clarify, you know, that exemption. And at this point, Department of Human Services staff believe the state is in compliance with this prompt pay requirement. The Act also provides that the state is not eligible for the 6.2% increase and also not eligible for the unemployment-related increase if any funds directly or indirectly attributable to the FMAP increase are deposited or credited to any reserve or rainy day fund. There is also a state that reporting requirement. States that receive a higher FMAP need to report to the Secretary of HHS by September 30th, 2011 on how they spend these additional funds. The Act also has requirements that a state is not eligible for the FMAP increases if it increases the local government share of MA that the local government must pay to a greater percentage than what was in effect under the state plan as of September 30th of 2008.
Mr. John, if you go back to number 6, and that's the rainy day and reserve fund, the way I understand it, we have about $450 million of FMAP money coming in this fiscal year. And what happens if we don't spend that? Does this go to the bottom line then? And is that legal according to the federal rules?
Mr. Chair, I don't know the answer to that question. I think I'll need to kind of consult with the agency and other staff. Mr. Chair, I guess now I'd like to move on to some of the non-FMAP provisions, and I'll go over these more briefly. The Act increases the Medicaid disproportionate share hospital allotments by 2.5% in federal fiscal year 2009 and by an additional 2.5% in federal fiscal year 2010. And these DISH payments are made by the MA program to hospitals that the state has designated as serving a disproportionate share of either low-income or uninsured patients. DISH payments use the same, I guess, state and federal match percentages of 50% federal, 50% state. And to access this money, the state therefore needs to put up a state, you know, share, and then it's matched by the federal DISH contribution. The Act also extends from April 1st, 2009 to July 1st of 2009 the moratorium that's already in place in law on the federal government adopting final recommendations for specific areas. These would be related to case management services, provider taxes, Medicaid payments for school-based administration and transportation, and outpatient hospital facility services. These are generally provisions that states or counties had raised concerns with CMS about. The Act also contains a sort of a sense of Congress resolution that the Secretary of Health and Human Services should not adopt final regulations on cost limits for certain providers, payments for graduate medical education, and rehabilitation services. The Act also extends work-related transitional medical assistance through December 31st of 2010. Funding would otherwise have expired June 30th of 2009. And the Act also broadens eligibility for transitional medical assistance. What transitional medical assistance does is it allows continued MA eligibility for persons who otherwise would have become ineligible due to increased income or loss of an earned income disregard. The Act also extends the Qualified Individual Program. It extends it to December 31st of 2010. Otherwise, this would have expired in 2009. The Qualified Individual Program pays for Medicare Part B premiums for individuals who meet certain income and asset standards that are higher than the regular, you know, MA standards. The Act also contains a number of provisions that relate to American Indians and healthcare and Indian, I guess, health service providers. They deal with cost sharing for Indian recipients, payments of Indian healthcare providers, determination of assets for eligibility and asset recovery, and also managed care plan requirements. And the general goal here is to increase access to providers and to sort of support the financial viability of Indian providers. The Act also appropriates money to the Office of the Inspector General, the Department of Health and Human Services, to ensure the proper expenditure of Medicaid funds. The Act also appropriates money to the Secretary of Health and Human Services to implement the increase in FMAP. And finally, there is a GAO study. The Act directs the Comptroller General of the U.S. to study the national economic downturn and report to Congress by April 1st of 2011. The report needs to make recommendations on temporary adjustments in FMAP and also address specific topics that are listed in this document. And Mr. Chair, that concludes the, I guess, Medicaid portion of our presentation.
Any questions on the MA part of the bill? Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Mr. Chen. This might be a question that that we need to do more research on, but I'm just looking at where is the section? On the moratoria on certain Medicaid regulations. Mm-hmm. And the second section on the purpose sent to the Congress. Can you explain a little more about what you think that means for us?
Sure. Mr. Director Murphy, are you referring to the phrase sense of Congress, I mean that term?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Tan, I am interested in knowing what it means in terms of the cost limits for certain providers, et cetera, so for the bulleted items
sure.
below.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, what this is that there is a rule, I guess, being proposed that would sort of clarify. I think it's tied to the whole sort of intergovernmental transfer certified public expenditure issue. So it sort of would be clarifying what would be a unit of government for this, what documentation requirements are required. There's also some limits on Medicaid reimbursement. And I think that, again, this is similar to some of the other rules that were of concern where I think states sometimes feel that this may limit their flexibility on the Medicaid or may have the effect of reducing some of their Medicaid funding. And this is an area where I think states and federal governments have, you know, over a number of years have had some disagreements.
Representative Hodge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize if my question was covered earlier when I wasn't in the committee, but on the maintenance of effort provisions, it says that that we're eligible for the money as long as we're not, as that we can't change eligibility standards, methodologies, or procedures.
Mm-hmm.
What defines eligibility standards, methodologies, or procedures? Does a benefit set
include that, or?
Mr. Chair, Rep. Posh, I think the, you know, the short answer is that we, at this point, we don't have any more clarification than that phrase that's in the Act. But I think it's generally thought that that the MOE requirement would be more likely to apply to things that are eligibility standards, such as income standards or asset standards, things like that, rather than a benefit set. But I think this is something where we're waiting for clarification from the federal government.
Representative Hodge. Another question, Mr. Chair, and it's a hypothetical, so I don't know if you can answer, but the governor's budget recommended you know, pretty much the elimination of GAMC and Minnesota Care for Adults and Adult Children. I'm assuming that we can still make those cuts to GAMC because those aren't Medicaid. That's not a program funded with Medicaid dollars. But if we do follow the governor's provisions with eliminating GAMC, are those people who are eligible for GAMC, then would they be eligible for the Minnesota Care provision of adults, adult children, because we can't touch that? I don't know.
Mr. Restipash, I think the way this probably would work is that the maintenance of effort, it's tied sort of to the Medicaid program and to related waivers. So we get funding under Minnesota Care for parents and children under one of these related waivers. So it would limit, I think, the extent to which the state could say eliminate eligibility or reduce eligibility for children and pregnant women, you know, those groups for which, and parents, those groups for which we get some type of federal match. But, for example, for adults without children on Minnesota Care, because that's not related to the Medicaid program and we're not getting a federal match, you know, it would be, it probably be something that could still be done, although I think with anything, it'd be good, you know, if we can get further clarification on all of those points.
Thank you. Representative Skiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question on the FMAP. On page one, there's adjustments to FMAP. And I'm reading several numbers, so I'm just not quite sure where we are at. And I do understand that the 6.2 percentage points, okay? And then under C, there's the unemployment-related FMAP, which it says here Minnesota is high enough to qualify for that adjustment. Further on, it says there's Minnesota 3.99 points for the first three quarters, and then there's a July 109 to 5.39 percentage points. So
okay.
All of those together, not quite sure where we end up in the end.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Mr. Pittmeyer, the projected FMAP for the period October 1st, 2008 through March of 2009 is 60.19%. So this basically is the sum of, you know, our standard 50%, then the 6.2% additional FMAP that all states get, and then an additional employment-related FMAP of 3.99 percentage points that Minnesota gets, and that 3.99% is tied to our unemployment rate and us being in that middle tier. Now, the reference to, I think, a higher FMAP is because it's anticipated that Minnesota will, the unemployment rate in the state will get worse. So therefore, I think it's in either the third or fourth quarter of 09 is when we may move to the higher FMAP category.
Representative Schiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Chen, my question then is, does that go on top of the 60.19?
Mr. Rester Schiffmeyer, the 5.39 would be, or the difference between, I guess, 5.39 and 3.99 would be added to the 60.19. So I think we would be at, I don't know if I had that, I think it's estimated that we may be at 61.59%. This would be for the quarter ending September 30th of 2009.
61.59?
Yes, that's correct. So if I can just elaborate, I guess, you know, basically we will always get the 6.2%, then we will always get the 3.99%, at least, you know, for a specified period. But if our unemployment rate gets worse when we move up to the higher tier, as is being projected, then we would move up to the 61.59%.
Representative Thiessen.
Yeah, just on the benefit set side of things, it's my understanding that the federal law actually explicitly says we can change benefit sets. Mm-hmm. Is that so? It has doesn't affect eligibility, right? Is that so? That's wide open.
Mr. Chair, I think that is correct. Now that I'm recalling something in the actual law that I believe did say that.
I think there is something in it that practically says benefits that are
right
open.
So you're talking dental benefits and occupational therapy and physical therapy. We could eliminate those. Now, some of those are covered partially by Medicare, so you're talking about people in nursing homes that get pretty complex. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chun, my question is about the couple of tables that are in here that show how much additional funding we'll be getting. And what I'm not understanding is the column that's HDAF, which I assume is Healthcare Access Fund. And so I'm assuming that we're getting additional funding there because some of the maybe I should just ask you, why are we getting an addition there? What does it mean that we're getting additional money in the Healthcare Access Fund? Mm-hmm. Does that mean that additional money that comes in there then becomes part of that fund? Or what is that? Maybe just explain that to me, please.
Mr. Liebling, I think the reference there, and maybe fiscal staff can elaborate more on this, but I believe it's because under Minnesota CARE, we're getting a federal match for parents and children and pregnant women on the Minnesota CARE program. So I believe that's why we have a Healthcare Access Fund reference.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chun, well, that helps some, but are they just breaking it out here just to sort of show what the source of the match is? Or does it mean something that it's in a separate column? I mean, is that fund then, is this additional piece of the money restricted in some other way, or does it just become part of the MA match funds that we have available to use like the other funds?
Mr. Chair, that's the reason. I think, and maybe DHS can elaborate more. These numbers were provided in this format by them, but I think it's tied to the population. In fact, I'll let Mr. Walls answer.
Mr. Walls.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I believe that the figures that you're looking at in the Healthcare Access Fund column represent, it comes from the reauthorization of SCHIP. And the CHIP money that now comes into the state used to go in a category that covered pregnant women and children, and that waiver has expired. It's now going to be used for children, and there's a different FMAP percentage that is more advantageous to the state than the previous waiver was. So we're going to be receiving additional federal dollars to help fund healthcare access, help fund Minnesota CARE, and these healthcare access fund dollars are those that would be saved because of the additional federal money in that program.
But Representative Lee, when that money then is subject to whatever the separate rules we have for the Healthcare Access Fund versus the general fund, which means they can carry over if there's a surplus. Let's see, Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question relates back to what Representative Hawks was talking about on page with the maintenance of effort regarding the eligibility standards, et cetera. So they wouldn't be able to be changed, but the reimbursement could change. Is that right?
Mr. Rustin-Scalzi, are you asking whether we can change a Medicaid provider reimbursement and
right.
not...
If we don't change the eligibility to the reimbursement.
Right. Mr. Vestalzi, if the question is whether this maintenance of effort
I guess, applies to, say, Medicaid provider reimbursement levels. You know, I don't think it does, again, because of the language of the Act referring to eligibility standards, if I understand your question correctly. So I think the main question is really just what does the term, you know, eligibility procedures, standards, and so on mean, and that's something that I think the CMS will be clarifying, hopefully, soon.
It's my understanding we could, if we wanted to, we could cut the reimbursement rates in half.
Mm-hmm.
If we wanted to, which I don't suggest we should do, but the other side of the argument is if we don't spend roughly what we're spending now, then we'll leave federal dollars on the table and we won't spend it. So, next chair. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one point on page 3, Mr. Chun. Item number 6, the rainy day and reserve funds provision. I guess I'm just curious about how we keep track of this. And this might be a question for you in terms of the federal legislation, if there's some means that we're supposed to be reporting back, or maybe it's a question for Mr. Walls, and how going forward we track the money so that we make sure it doesn't end up through the forecast in some rainy day fund.
Mr. Walls, do you want to answer that, or Mr. Chun?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I believe the thinking here, and I'm not positive, is that this FMAP increase for fiscal 2009 will, the FMAP will be increased, and those dollars basically will be spent as federal dollars by the end of 2009. The savings created are state general fund dollars, and there's no restriction on those being carried forward.
Okay. We have a quorum now, so would somebody like to move the minutes?
I'd like to move the minutes, then I have a question. So I'll pay the price of making the motion of the excellent minutes that are there.
Okay, and there's two sets.
Both sets.
Three sets.
All the sets you can possibly.
So Representative Abler moves three sets of minutes. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So we've adopted the minutes. And Representative Abler.
Just one more. Are these numbers in the forecast with the inclusion of that increased unemployment piece, or is this the base chart in the forecast, you know?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, there are many categories of funding in the federal stimulus bill. Some have been counted, some have not. As far as FMAP for Medicaid, those dollars have been counted in the forecast.
Mr. Chair, but the unemployment part? Is that not part of the forecast?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, I believe those have been included in
the budget. They are included, including it's about $1.3 billion in the next biennium of extra FMAP money. And it's included in the budget. But it's not sure yet if the governor is going to spend that money. And whether he will put up the match or suggest that we put up the match to draw down all that money. So it's not clear yet.
More dialogue to come.
Okay. No other. Representative Liebling.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you. So are you saying the governor might be counting the revenue, but maybe not the expenses?
No.
Well, Representative Liebling, in the forecast there is that $1.3 billion in the next biennium, and if we don't put up our share, we're not going to be able to draw that money down. Now, we'll draw a big chunk of it down, but the question is, do we go all the way? So I think that was the last question. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Yep, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Leading off on your question there, maybe Mr. Chen knows the answer, maybe somebody else does. Do we have any dollar amount of what money
is not in the forecast that is still available or being used in some way?
There. I think we'll hear a little bit more about that later, but there is some stabilization money that we, but some of that's tied up, and it is very, and that's about $800 million, but it's probably not going to this department. But there's okay. Some others, and there's some competitive grants. I don't know. Mr. Walls, do you want to address that?
Mr. Chair, I would only say that there, among the different categories of federal money, there is some emergency TANF that may or may not be able to be counted in the future, depending on what the state does. There are some other categories that may or may not be used, but there are, between the different categories, in some cases the federal law specifies these funds must be used to supplement and not supplant, and in other categories that distinction is not made. So there may be potential for some small areas of savings depending on the funding.
Representative Bunch. Nope. So, Ms. Lemire, do you want to give your presentation?
Yes, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Danielle Lemire from House Research, and the information that I'm going to be going over is the human services provisions that were in the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, and all of the information that I'm going to provide is included in this MCSL document that should be in your packet. I'm going to be focusing on the temporary assistance to needy families and the supplemental nutrition assistance program. There were also some things in the federal stimulus act related to nutrition assistance for aging services programs, child support enforcement, child welfare programs, the community services block grant, and supplemental security income, which are included in this MCSL document that I won't be going over, but the information is there if you're interested. As for the temporary assistance to needy families program, there are a couple of changes that were included in the act that could affect Minnesota. The first one is a TANF carry forward policy change, and this allows states to use their carry forward TANF funds to provide any benefits and services permitted under TANF instead of just limiting those carry forward funds to being used for cash assistance. So it basically just gives the state a little bit more flexibility in using those funds if we have funds that we're carrying forward from one year to the next. The next provision related to TANF that could impact the state is the TANF Emergency Contingency Fund. This is a new fund created within the TANF program. The funds will be used to make grants in fiscal years 2009 and 2010 for states in three areas: cash assistance, caseload increases, non-recurring short-term benefits, and expenditures for subsidized employment. The fund will reimburse states for 80% of the increased expenditures for those three categories: cash, welfare, short-term non-recurring benefits, and subsidized employment. There's no state match or new MOE requirements to draw down these funds. In order to be reimbursed for this, for the cash welfare part, states must demonstrate an overall cash welfare caseload increase. And the increase is compared to a corresponding quarter of a base year, which will either be 2007 or 2008, whichever year had the lowest caseload. And then the states must demonstrate increased expenditures through a similar methodology, comparing expenditures under all three of those categories to either 2007 or 2008, whichever is more advantageous to the state. And states can choose different base years for those three different categories of funding. And then one other provision that could be advantageous to the state. There's a two-year hold harmless to the caseload reduction credit to assist states in meeting the work participation rate.
Representative Pease?
I got my second.
Oh, thank you.
So that's all I was going to cover related to TANF. The next thing I was going to go through is
Mr. Chair, actually on that last thing, what does that mean? A whole harmless of the caseload reduction credit.
The state has each state has a work participation rate that they're supposed to meet, and we get a credit for the amount that we've reduced caseload to offset that work participation rate, and it's just a hold harmless to that for the next couple of years.
Representative Hodge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You say here that the states must demonstrate, depending on the base period, increased expenditures. I'm wondering what relationship that has with the increased flexibility we have with the carryover and some of the refinancing proposals. Would the refinancing that proposed with that negatively affect our eligibility for some of these dollars?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hodge, I'm not sure how those things are going to interact. I don't know if Mr. Walls has a better idea. I think that's probably something that would have to be clarified with the department and possibly with the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Mr. Walls,
I'm sure we'll get a quick answer to that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hodge, if I understood your question correctly, as long as the state stays above its MOE guidelines, we would continue to receive the federal TANF grant. As far as carry forward, I don't know that becomes a problem, as we currently have refinanced down to roughly zero. And in the governor's proposal, he does some benefit reductions and then refinances again. If we were to follow a similar methodology, there would be no money to carry forward.
Representative,
Mr. Chair, I just feel like this part, there's a lot of moving parts when it comes to potential eligibility for these dollars, increased expenditure guidelines, refinancing, and I think to try to get an answer is going to be tough to find, but I really hope that we dig into this and try to maximize some of the potential funds that are available to us, because this is one area that, I mean, even though 2008 was probably a historical low for caseloads, that's not going to occur in the next few years, and I don't want to minimize our eligibility for anything.
Well, HHS and the CMS are still writing the rules on this, and so we don't know for sure. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just reminded, when you're talking about the new TANF money from the fund, in the earlier NCSL brief that I read quickly, they were talking about some states being eligible for pieces of this, and some not based on maintenance of effort, but based on trajectory. When you talk about increasing caseloads, is that what you're talking about?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, I think that's probably what they're talking about, is just looking at the caseloads and what's happening in different states.
Mr. Chair,
Dean.
According to the last brief, it would be a state-by-state review, so I think they said that Michigan was not going to be receiving any of the new money, and Illinois perhaps not, because they had declining caseloads, and we would. Is that your understanding of this section of what you're reporting on right now?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, I haven't looked at what's happening with other states, so I can't speak to what would be happening in Michigan or Illinois.
Thank you.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just missed this, but short-term non-recurring benefits, could you just give us some examples of what those might be?
Ms. LeMaire.
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, I think there's a whole list of different short-term services that counties can provide to people through the TANF money that they get. And I'm not really thinking of what any of those are off the top of my head right now, but I'm thinking that that's one potential thing that might be eligible for that is the diversionary work program, which is supposed to be 4 months of benefits to help people sort of get back into the workforce quickly.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, could we, you said there's a list of them. That would be, I think, a really important list for us to have.
Sure, I can get that for you.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two things. First, is this carryover TANF policy change, is that a permanent change, or is that just kind of in the same time frame as the stimulus package for some of these other things?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, I'm not sure if that's a permanent change or if that's just temporary. I'd have to go back and double check.
Okay. And the second thing is, I do think that the issue that Representative Dean raised, it would be really good to get clarification around that issue.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be helpful.
Okay, Mr. Chair, if there aren't any other questions on the TANF piece, I'll go ahead and talk about the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, which is formerly known as the Food Stamp Program. The maximum benefit for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program is being increased by 13.6%. I believe this takes effect on April 1st. There's also an appropriation in fiscal years 2009 and 10 for administrative expenses for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. This money is going to be allocated to states based on 75% on each state's share of the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program households for the most recent 12-month period for which data is available, and the other 25% will be allocated based on the increase in the number of households participating in the program as reported in the most recent 12-month period, and there's no MOE requirements for these funds. And Mr. Chair, unless people have questions about that piece, that
questions? I don't see any. Go ahead.
That concludes what I was going to talk about.
Okay, any further questions? Then I think we're going to James Golden from the Department of Health.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Jim Golden. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Health, and I actually have a presentation that is large enough that you can actually read it. As soon as it comes up here, we'll get that up on the screen. I guess one thing to say while that's coming up, it's nice to see that the federal government is starting to get where Minnesota has been, both the legislature and the governor and the community, over the past 4 years. Much of what I'm going to talk about in my presentation today are things that we have been doing in Minnesota in one form or another since 2004 in a very collaborative public-private partnership. Mr. Chair and committee members, as I was saying, Minnesota has had the Minnesota eHealth Initiative, which is a public-private collaborative which has basically been looking at how can we accelerate the adoption and use of health information technology, specifically electronic health records in Minnesota. Minnesota is one of the leaders in this area. Minnesota has a requirement in statute that everyone in the healthcare industry start to do electronic prescribing by 2011, have electronic health records by 2015, that we have a statewide plan to figure out how to meet those goals. The legislature has also provided, over the last 3 years, approximately $14.6 million for funding loans and grants. $8.3 million of that went out in grants, and $6.3 million went out in a loan program to help providers finance electronic health records. We've also been doing this in a wide variety of communities. We've funded 46 grant programs, which include 120 providers in all the communities of the state. And we've given out $6.3 million in loans, and we've had requests for $14.1 million. These are all important background details once you start to see what's in the federal stimulus package. One of the things that I'd like to say is that you'll see a lot of numbers thrown around with regard to what's actually in the health information technology section. First of all, it's called HITECH, the HITECH Act, and you'll often see the number that there's $19 billion. It's probably better to think of that as $31 billion, and the reason is this. There's actually $29 billion that goes out to providers in incentives to adopt electronic health records, and there are incentives in the early years, and there are financial disincentives in the later years. So what they're really going to be doing is providing $29 billion worth of incentives. So there's really $29 billion that's there, and for whatever isn't captured in those early years, ultimately become a disincentive in the later years.
And how, you're probably going to address this, but how does that get distributed amongst the states?
Mr. Chair, I'll get to that in just a second. The first thing to understand of that $31 billion is that there are really two pots of money. There are $2 billion that went to HHS, primarily to the Office of the National Coordinator for Health Information Technology. Of that $2 billion, $300 million of that goes to regional efforts to develop the exchange of electronic health information between providers who are treating patients. Another $20 million of that goes to the National Institute for Standards and Technology, and that's for testing of standards and helping to make sure that the standards that get developed work. That leaves about $1.68 billion for a variety of projects that I will be talking about. The other and the more important piece is really the $29 billion that goes to healthcare providers in Medicare and Medicaid incentive payments. Those incentive payments start in 2011. They estimate $29 billion available for those payments. Starting in about 2015, there are disincentives for people who are not meaningful users of electronic health records. And as I say, the reason there's a difference between the $29 billion I'm talking about and the $17 billion that you often see quoted is because they estimate that it will reduce federal spending by about $12 billion, either through improved quality of care or through disincentives that come into effect starting in 2015.
And Mr. Goldman, does that money go through the state, or does it go, I mean, do we have control over it, or does it go directly to the provider?
In the case of Medicare, it would go directly to the providers. Under Medicare, you'll see later that it's physicians and hospitals. And then under Medicaid, it would come through the Department of Human Services, and it would include hospitals, physicians, dentists, physician assistants, and a couple of other provider groups as well. I think one of the other things that's probably important is I'm going to go through some of the possible activities. I think one of the strategies is really, in thinking about the $2 billion, or whatever portion of that $2 billion is ultimately going to be available to states, the real goal of the state should be to capture as much of it as one can for the purposes of really helping the providers be able to get as much of those incentive payments as we can. And part of one of the things that we've taken a look at is just taking a 2% portion of that, the Medicaid and Medicare incentives, that would be about $580 million to help finance health information technology in the state. Given that Minnesota is ahead of where most states are, we would expect to be able to pull down more of those incentive dollars on an earlier time frame. One of the things that we are doing that we'll talk a little bit later about is taking an estimate as to if everything went perfectly, what are some of the amounts that we could expect to see the private sector providers getting in incentive payments.
So Mr. Golden, this will be the one time we don't get punished for being good?
Mr. Chair, this would be the one time when it's a really good the first and be prepared for enough front on this. Which slide am I on? The HIT portion of the package really has four pieces, and this is what is used, this is what the $2 billion is used to fund. There's a number of activities that the Office of the National Coordinator is required to do at the federal level. There's some work that the National Institutes of Standards and Technology will be doing in coordination with HHS, really looking at trying to make sure that standards for interoperability and exchange are working properly. I think the section that will be of most interest to this committee is those in Subtitle C, which is really the grants and loans and technical assistance sections. And then finally, a portion I'm not going to talk very much about today in this committee is Subtitle D, which is some improved privacy and security protections to help protect individuals' data as it's in various systems. Subtitle A puts a number of requirements on the federal government. Those requirements will be important to us because we need some of the things that they're required to accomplish, as well as we're going to want to make sure that we participate up front in some of their activities. First and foremost, they need to update their overall health information technology strategic plan. Much like Minnesota, they published a plan last June, which kind of laid out their direction for how to get to adoption, effective use, and the exchange of health information through electronic health records. Coincidentally, we also published a state plan for this in June of last year. They will be required to update their plan, and one of the things that they will require states to do is make sure that they have a plan, or in our case, make sure that the plan is updated to be consistent with their plan. They are also required to establish HIT policy committee to guide the overall direction, and they're also required to establish a standards committee. The standards committee is going to be ramped up significantly from most of the national and federal activities thus far on standards. Their responsibility will be to put together all of the standards which will go into electronic health records and the certification of electronic health records to make sure that they're using common languages and standards to be able to exchange information. One of the reasons that this is important is we, of course, need standards. We need the vendors to put those standards into products, and we need them to be standards that work for us. A good example of how this will mean some work for Minnesota, one of the things that we've been doing with the eHealth Advisory Committee is we've been collecting up and working with providers and payers in analyzing standards that have already been looked at the national level. So, for example, earlier this year, there were some standards that came out on a variety of topics that included inpatient ambulatory emergency departments, cardiovascular, and children's health. There were approximately 1,400 specific criteria that were proposed in those standards. One of the things that we did with the eHealth Advisory Committee was to go through each of those standards and see how do they work for Minnesota. As a result of that, we pointed out to them that we thought there were 40 specific areas that had something missing and needed an additional criteria. There were 77 criteria that we thought didn't fit appropriately and work well with the way that care was delivered in Minnesota. Minnesota was the only state that submitted these types of comments to the national people, and as a result, we were given special attention, and many of our suggestions were incorporated into the final standard. This is the same type of activity that will need to occur as we move forward. The federal government, with regard to their standards committee, are going to be required to publish for comment all of those standards. To the degree we can continue to speak as a state in a coordinated fashion with one voice, we're much more likely to have those standards reflect the needs of Minnesota, which will ultimately reduce the cost and effort of implementing those standards in Minnesota.
Likewise, the national office is required to put in a chief privacy officer, and they're required to make grants to regional efforts to help exchange information across providers. An organization such as MNHI, which is the exchange that we have been working with and has come out of the e-health initiative, is likely to be a entity that could receive funds under this provision. I won't go too much into what Subtitle B is. That's really doing a couple of things. One is having the National Institute for Standards and Technology look at the standards and do some testing. The other opportunity that would be an opportunity for the state is really the second bullet point there. And there, they're required to establish healthcare information integration research centers. It's a lot of words. But essentially what that is they are going to be looking at institutions of higher education to look at some research issues around electronic health records. How do you use these better? How do you do things such as have better interfaces? How do you have voice recognition be a better component of electronic health records? How do you make sure that you have adequate software dependability so that it doesn't go down in critical situations? How do you structure information to make it useful to the provider in the middle of care? Again, this is something that Minnesota as a state could apply for. It's likely to be focused at an institution of higher education, the University, St. Scholastica, or one of the other organizations that have been doing work in this area.
Representative,
thank you. Just on the standards issue, so Minnesota has put some standards into law. Do those standards fit under this umbrella?
Mr. Chair, Representative Stephen, yes, they do. We anticipate that the first thing that the federal government will do is take all of the already adopted standards. There's been a national standard setting process and a certification process. The law actually requires that those standards be the starting spot, and those are the standards that Minnesota has adopted. So we've essentially waited until they were well baked before we put them into our law.
Okay.
As I said, Subtitle C is likely to be the area of greatest interest. The little text that you see is what the responsibility generally on the Secretary of HHS is to use the funds to invest in the infrastructure necessary to adopt, use, and exchange health information. The first thing that the Secretary needs to do is put together a HIT extension program at the national level, and then to contract with regional extension programs. And those regional extension programs do exactly what you would expect an extension program to do. Their primary responsibility will be technical assistance to organizations in learning how to adopt, how to change their care to better fit with electronic health records, and then how to be able to exchange information so that they get the patient's information when they need it. The priority for both the national and regional extension centers will be first not-for-profit hospitals and critical access hospitals, federally qualified health centers, entities that focus on the uninsured, underinsured, and medically underserved individuals, and then finally small group practices that are focused on primary care. So really the outreach and technical assistance will focus on those parts that probably most need the assistance and would benefit from integrating these technologies.
Representative Beeson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so this is actually, it would be like an extension service, like we have at the University of Minnesota, that there's some entity that goes around to these different places to help them. There's a New York Times article. Is that what we're talking about New York City?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beeson, it is more or less exactly like that. The idea is that they would provide technical assistance.
Do these exist today, or we'd have to create them in Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, President Stephen, I would say that they do exist. As an example, there has been Stratus Health. Stratus Health has been doing a number of things as a QIO on the DOCKET program, which has been focused primarily on the adoption and making sure that you do the planning up front for that. I think that that would be an example. There might be some others that have done some outreach, but that would be a good example.
And Mr. Golden, there is, I think, another pot of money in the stimulus package that goes to FQHCs. And who's going to organize all these different activities that are going on? I mean, is that the Department of Health, or is that Department of Human Services would be involved in that? Or
Mr. Chair, the answer to the first question is it's true there's, I believe, $1.5 billion that will go through HRSA that would be specifically for federally qualified health centers. The $1.5 billion is for capital improvements, and capital improvements can include health information technologies. Those funds would undoubtedly, we believe, go through HRSA directly to the federally qualified health centers. I believe that the coordination question is twofold. At the federal level, it is the responsibility of HHS and specifically the Office of the National Coordinator to coordinate across state agencies. Within the state of Minnesota, the Department of Health has led the public-private e-health advisory committee to try to make sure that we have a coordinated approach, and that has a wide variety of stakeholders, including providers, hospitals, nursing homes, payers, state agencies, consumers, and a variety of others, local public health, for example. And that goal, that committee has really tried to make sure that we have a consistent and common focus across all parts of the healthcare system.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Golden, can you, I think I heard you right say that part of this money is going to be used to help change how we provide care to fit with the record. Did I hear that correctly? And if so, can you just talk about that a little bit more, please?
I can. Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, you know, I think some of the challenges is, for example, in just going from a paper record to an electronic record, it really allows us to do a wide variety of things that weren't possible in an electronic record. Take, for example, just medication management. You know, one of the things that can be done with that is you can have decision support that allows you to check to see does the medication that you're about to administer, is it going to conflict with other medications that they're on? Are there allergies? A number of institutions have gone to barcoding, where you can also check to make sure that what you're about to administer is, in fact, the drug that you think that it is. It can also look to see when the last drug has been administered. And it can do all of this without having to go find that paper chart. And there's a number of those types of issues that as providers need to just change those types of activities instead of looking for the charts or having someone get the chart, or how do you actually put in a order into the electronic health record. But there are probably better and worse ways to kind of do that. And there are a lot of organizations that already have experience in dealing with that. A number of care providers have talked about some of the challenges of having a computer in the room and between them and the patient. How are some of the ways to deal with that so that you're still able to connect with the patient? And I think really what the goal of some of those research centers are to find ways to minimize some of those barriers and challenges, at the same time finding ways to distribute some of the best practices and lessons learned so that this is really a technology to improve care and the quality of care, as opposed to a technology for technology's sake. I think.
One more, Representative Ebert.
Thanks. I hope this is the right time to ask a question. Somebody was telling me that there were some grants to small clinics, like to do computerization. But it sounds like what you're doing, what you've mentioned, at least when I heard, I was at a different meeting for a bit, is for more outreach to groups that are doing primary care and like that. Is that, was my contact wrong about that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, there are some grants that will go to small clinics, specifically, for example, federally qualified health centers. The bill doesn't prohibit grants going to clinics, but I will be suspicious if there are a lot of grants that come out of this money that actually go to anyone. I think the primary mechanism will probably be a loan mechanism, and I think we can talk about that through this, because the real money that's going to go to the clinics or to the hospitals or to the physicians is going to be through either the Medicare or Medicaid incentive payments. And so that's really why I think we want to focus our efforts is finding
all of the tools that can help providers get what they need in place to get as much of that money as they can.
Mister, that's what I thought he'd say.
Representative.
That's what I told the guy.
Dr. Golden.
There is a required program that the secretary must do, and that's actually state grants. It's actually grants that come into the state. I'm not quite sure why it says optional on that one. I'm on the wrong page. This is actually required by HHS to do. There will be both planning and implementation grants. There is a federal match that's required. In the first year, that is left to the secretary as to what the match would need to be.
Yes.
Starting in fiscal 11, it's a 1 to 10 pull down. In 12, it's a 1 to 7. And then in 13, it's a 1 to 3. These would be for things such as looking at how do we use state resources to help providers, how do we start to have technical assistance to providers, how do we implement the priorities of both the state and the federal government around HIT at the state level. We do anticipate that they will do this, but we don't know anything on, at this point, the amount that would be available under this particular program. This is the slide I had in front of me. This particular program is a loan program, so the states are eligible to get federal money for a loan program. One of the important things in Minnesota is we already have a loan program. It's a revolving loan fund that was funded with $6.3 million of healthcare access funds in the 2007 legislative session. Our loan program is very, very consistent with this. There would be a couple of very minor changes that we would need to make just to be consistent with the requirements. An example would be in Minnesota law, we give them a 2-year grace period from paying back the loan. Under federal law, the maximum grace period would be a 1-year grace period before they would have to start paying back the loan. So there are some very technical changes like that, but otherwise, this is fully consistent. And the idea of this is a provider would get a loan in order to purchase and utilize an EHR, train their personnel, or to upgrade an existing system to come into compliance. And so this is really the primary funding mechanism to help fund the capital expenditures that we would anticipate the providers having in order to get the maximum pull down. So while this is optional, we do anticipate that they would do this, and we do anticipate that this would be one of the primary vehicles for the bridge funding between the incentive payments and the expenditures. This does have a match requirement. It's $1 of state funds for every $5 of federal funds. There are a couple of other things that are in the bill that would be available for the state to get. One would be a grant to develop academic curricula. This is, again, an optional project, and the idea would be that this would go to institutions of higher education to help them develop curricula that could then be given to other schools that train various types of healthcare professionals. And so this would be an example of, for example, St. Scholastica has been doing quite a lot around the nursing area, looking at how do you train nurses to be able to integrate HIT directly into their activities from the first day in nursing school. This would be the type of program that would be eligible for that, and this is something that then would be used for other schools who may be picking up this program to institute those various activities. The other activity that's there, which again would be a higher education activity, would be the promotion of information technology specialists or professionals in healthcare. So this is thinking about as we put more and more of this technology into the healthcare setting, you're going to need IT people to help support this, to help maintain it. And what this would do is, how do we strengthen those types of programs of higher education, and how do we start to train people to get them into these professions quickly and to deal with some of the displacement of workers. As you'll see from the very last point on the slide, that this program is really going to be prioritized towards two things: existing programs and programs that train people and put them back into the workforce in 6 months. So that would be the priority, and whichever institutions might be having those types of programs are most likely to be able to apply and receive funds for this.
As I said, there are some improved privacy and security provisions there, some enhanced enforcement, which allows state attorney generals to do some enforcement. It also does some stuff to strengthen personal health records, which would allow some of the breach notifications that exist today in Minnesota to also apply to personal health records when they're maintained by organizations such as Google or Microsoft or the like.
Representative Bunn has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll find out if we had time today or if we had one more speaker. The question I had has to do with both the current one and the previous two slides. One, the issue of training people to do health information technology, and also linked to the whole privacy issue. A couple major trends in the whole IT area generally. One of the areas that's becoming most outsourced, I mean a lot of unemployed mid-level and even high-level IT people when I walk throughout my district. It's one of kind of the most easily outsourceable things in some ways, or in among professionals. Then we also have stories and news stories over the last couple years about health information that's been outsourced to another state or another organization, and that there's been some security privacy type breaches. As we move to a more electronically based health information system and with health records, well, first of all, on the job side, it seems like we have a lot of IT folks who should be easily retrained in this area, specifically to healthcare, that would be out there. But secondly, the issue about, unlike the general IT area, whether or not we want to have, under this whole privacy guideline issue, much greater security in this area in terms of who can, you know, what kind of firms, what kind of, you know, and what kind of organizations can do this work compared to what's been done generally in the past.
Dr. Golden.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bunn, I think those are both very good points. With regard to the first point of dealing with some displaced workers, I think that is one of the reasons that in the bill there is a priority placed on programs that are put people back into the workforce in 6 months. And so I do think that there will be opportunities, and hopefully some of our educational institutions will be able to avail themselves and help some of those displaced workers that you're aware of. With regard to the privacy, I do think that, you know, there is going to be an ongoing discussion about some of the privacy and security features around that. To the degree that extends to the workforce on a need-to-know basis and to how they're participating in these, I think those are legitimate issues, and we will certainly make sure to keep aware of those, certainly in our state efforts, and to the degree that there's more discussion at the federal level, keep you aware of those.
For those around you, Mr. Gross will be talking to us tomorrow.
Mr. Chair, what you see here is a slide of the Medicare incentive payment for professionals. This is a schedule. If you start your first year of incentive payments in 2011 or 2012, if you're ready to do what it takes to get the money, you're going to get $18,000 the first year, $15,000 the second, $18,000 the first year, $12,000 the second, $8,000, $4,000, and $2,000. And then the longer you wait, the less money that you're going to have. What that table translates into is that for physicians who are using a certified electronic health record, they can receive up to $44,000 in incentive payments from Medicare. If they're practicing in a health professional shortage area, they would be eligible for a 10% bonus, which would be $48,400. This applies to all physicians, regardless of when they purchase their electronic health record. So the degree to which we are already ahead of the curve and have more physicians using electronic health records, to the degree they meet the other requirements, they should be eligible for incentive payments in 2011. Those other requirements are that you need to be a meaningful user. There are essentially three requirements to be a meaningful user. You need to be using certified electronic health record technology. For the most part, we think most physicians that are using it today in Minnesota probably meet that criteria, or that can be met without too much trouble. They also need to report clinical quality measures that CMS would require. So in a physician, this would probably be the PQRI measures,
So this is again trying to focus on making sure that the quality is the first and foremost aspect around implementing these technologies. And then finally, they have to demonstrate that they're able and exchanging information. This is by far the criteria that is the least defined at this point. We don't anticipate that it will initially be too stringent, but we do anticipate that over time it will become increasingly more stringent, so that you do have to have mechanisms to actually be able to exchange information with other providers to make sure that the patient's information is flowing between the various people and care can be coordinated.
Sure. Representative Abert.
Is there a cap on this, or is this just like a forecast count? Or, like, is there a limit to how many clinics or physicians can get this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, no, you have to be a physician doing Medicare business that is at least more than this. So you have to have a volume of Medicare that's, $26,000, $28,000 in order to be able to capture this. Other than that, you just have to be a meaningful user. There are no other limits on that portion.
So if there's a 10-physician clinic, they can each get this? Or is it per clinic?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, no, that would be per physician. So, for example, if you had 10 physicians and they were all seeing reasonable Medicare volume and you were ready to go in 2011, you should be able to pull down the full $44,000 for all 10 of your physicians.
I see a growth industry, Mr. Chair.
The next one concerns Medicare incentives for hospitals. You will see there are a number of numbers that fly around as to what the maximum available is. In this slide, I have 16,000 over 4 years. Let me just caution you that realistically, nobody's going to be able to pull that down. The type of characteristics your hospital would need probably don't exist. We've done some internal analysis. For non-critical access hospitals, we believe that most of the hospitals would be eligible from approximately $2.5 to $8.5 million in incentive payments over the 4 years. And what that number is based on is based on their share of Medicare volume, their charity care, the number of discharges that they do, and how early they start, because there is a phase out associated with that as well. The other important...
Yeah, let me just ask, and that's independent if they've already purchased their electronic stuff and have it up and running, you still get this bonus?
Mr. Chair, that's exactly right. And so that's why, for those that are already up and running, we want to make sure that they can become a meaningful user under the definition, because they will be eligible for that bonus in 2011. The other thing to note about this, that starting in 2015, for those hospitals that have not been doing this, they will start to get reductions in their Medicare payments in 2015. With regard to the critical access hospitals, they will be eligible for cost-based reimbursement. The cost-based reimbursement is their Medicare share, so the general proportion of Medicare that they're doing, plus 20%. We have done some internal analysis. We believe that under this provision, the critical access hospitals in Minnesota would be eligible for approximately, on average, 84% of their depreciable costs. So that would be basically the capital that they're putting into their system. The final slide is regarding the Medicaid payments. As you can see, under Medicaid, providers are also eligible for payments. The payments and the providers that are eligible there are slightly different. Under Medicare, it was just physicians and hospitals. In the case of Medicare, it would be children's hospitals, regardless of their Medicaid volume, acute hospitals with at least 10% Medicaid volume, a professional in an FQHC or rural health center that sees at least 30% of needy individuals. And a needy individual is anyone who is Medicaid, SCHIP, or uninsured, or being served on a sliding fee scale. Almost certainly all of these organizations would meet this criteria. Any non-hospital-based professional with at least 30% Medicaid volume. Those professionals can be a physician, a dentist, a certified nurse midwife,
a nurse practitioner or a physician assistant. And then finally, any pediatrician with at least 20% volume, Medicaid volume. I think one of the important things to note with regard to physicians in particular, a physician is only eligible under Medicare or Medicaid, but not both. So they will have to take a look at their volumes and decide which one is going to be most advantageous for them. With regard to what is possible there, the Medicaid payment would cover up to 85% of their allowed costs. It would be covered at 100% of federal match, and the money to administer the program, because it would be a state-administered program out of the Department of Human Services, that program would receive a 90% match on the administration, and they would be required to come up with the 10% for the administration of the program.
Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a question for staff in addition to any of the three previous speakers, but possibly just for you and the staff. And it's true to the overall budget, but also specifically to this one, is I'm having some difficulty as we approach having to deal with issues of targets and cuts as to the net impact of our state decisions and the federal stimulus package. That in all these areas, whether it be hospitals or federally qualified health clinics, before making my decision about, you know, what state cuts or changes might be, I'd want to know what independently of my decision is going to happen to these folks via direct federal payments to them of some kind in the next, you know, 2-3 years. And I'm not sure how that's going to get sorted out for us in both the Health and Human Services area and overall in the budget, because education is going to get some direct things that go to school districts and, you know, not via the Department of Education. So anything that any of you, our speakers today, or this committee chair and staff could do to help clarify that for us in the next week and a half and as we go onwards as to how we would gather that information together to help our process, I'd appreciate that.
Well, this information is hot off the press, and in fact, a lot of it we don't know the details yet, but it certainly will fit in with our overall budget. And we'll try to get that information to you as quickly as possible. We're about out of time. Mr. Golan, it just struck me that there's so many different areas. You're talking about higher education institutions available to get some of this money. We're talking about public health, and you just talked about the information technology. There's also money for a public health initiative that sort of fits in with our SHIP program. And I guess my overall question, who's going to coordinate all this for the state? Are we just going to let the higher education institutions do what they want to do and let the Department of Health do what they want to do and let the Human Services Department do what they want to do? There's just a tremendous opportunity at this time if we really were organized, I think, to maximize the dollars we get here.
Mr. Chair, speaking only for the health information technology portion of the bill, I do think that there are a lot of opportunities, and I think there are a lot of opportunities for different organizations and players, whether it would be some of the state agencies, whether it would be the providers that are out serving people, whether it would be higher education, Stratus, MinHI, the university, St. Scholastica, or other institutions. But I do think that we have actually been doing a very good job at coordinating these activities through one central organization at this point, being the eHealth Advisory Committee. It's a very public activity. It's a very focused activity around those types of things. And I think that's why I started my presentation by saying there are an awful lot of opportunities. And to the degree that someone can take those and help people do stuff to get health information technology in place, that's great. I think that a lot of what our goal ought to be at this point is to focus on how do we most effectively use those portions of the $2 billion that are available to us to really then translate that into pulling down as much as we can of that $29 billion, because that could translate anywhere from 500
to $900 million coming into the state. And all of that money would be to purchase equipment, to have people that are installing the equipment, using the equipment, training people. There's an awful lot that gets generated through a trickle-down effect in that. So I think that's one of the keys that we'll want to be focused on as we're moving forward. And, you know, the challenge to help people see where those opportunities are and how they fit, I think we will do our best to help coordinate that in the way we've been doing for 5 years.
So maybe we could have the commissioner come in, because I mean there's money for the, as I said, for the public health, which Christian was as Chip. There is a major effort in this bill for primary care education, which would involve other institutions, and I just hope that we don't miss any opportunity to get this money here, and maybe we'll have to have a meeting with the Representative Rukavina's committee. That's higher ed. But primary care is a huge issue nationally. It's a huge issue in this state, and there is sufficient, or there is a lot of money in there for that. And we're out of time.
Mr. Chair, yes. Members, Barb Jolick, Department of Health. I just want to point out there is a supplemental set of information for some of those other grants, the prevention and wellness money, the provider training, professional training. So the summary, there's at least summary information there. We can have that other discussion as well.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. And this was, I think, a good example of how Minnesota is out in front for the rest of the country and not going to be punished for it. So the meeting is adjourned.
Okay.